We'll hear arguments next in Santa Clara Pueblo against Martinez. Mr. Palo, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case is before this court on a writ of certiorari to the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals. The case involves the application of Section 13028 of the Indian Civil Rights Act of 1968 as it applies to a Santa Clara Pueblo membership ordinance enacted in 1939. The ordinance provides that children born of Santa Clara males and Santa Clara females shall be Santa Clara members. Children born of Santa Clara males and non-Santa Clara females would likewise be members of the tribe, whereas children born of Santa Clara females and non-Santa Clara males would not be members of the tribe. The plaintiffs have alleged that the ordinance violates the Indian Civil Rights Act, and the defendants have continuously raised the lack of jurisdiction and the sovereign immunity of the tribe. The District Court for the District of New Mexico found that there was, in fact, jurisdiction, but that the ordinance did not violate the Indian Civil Rights Act. The Tenth Circuit reversed, not discussing tribal immunity to any extent whatsoever, and finding that, in fact, there was jurisdiction and that the ordinance was violated. A little factual background on Santa Clara Pueblo, I believe, would be beneficial before going into further argument. It is a small reservation, some 4,800 acres. The membership is small, approximately 1,200 members. It's located in the northern part of the state of New Mexico. It's a Tehuah tribe.
Whereabouts in the northern part of the state?
It's near Santa Fe, immediately north of Santa Fe. The tribe is organized pursuant to a constitution under the Reorganization Act of 1934, and it is uncontradicted that the tribe has existed as a distinct social and cultural unit for at least 700 years, and has existed at its present location for some 300 years. It's been surrounded first by the Spaniards and now by the United States of America, and has continued to exist, notwithstanding the fact that it has been surrounded by an alien culture.
Mr. Palo, does it make any difference in your argument whether this is in fact a reservation or whether the Santa Clara Pueblo is an Indian tribe?
May it please the court, I would use them identically.
Interchangeably?
Yes. The governor is the chief executive officer of the tribe that is empowered to run the day-to-day functions of the tribe primarily, and he serves on the council and can only vote on the council at such time as the council may have a tie vote. The council under the Constitution has the authority to determine membership in the tribe, and has thus done under the 1939 ordinance. The defendants in this case, Santa Clara Pueblo, have, from the very outset, claimed that the ordinance, the 1939 ordinance, is a written embodiment of pre-existing unwritten rules of membership. And I might point out that prior to 1935, nothing was written within the Pueblo culture. They had no written rules. They have further alleged throughout, and do so, that the ordinance is essential to the cultural and religious heritage and vital to the very existence of the tribe. There has been no variance from that ordinance from the time it was enacted. The plaintiff, Mrs. Martinez, is a Santa Clara Pueblan, daughter of both parents who were Santa Clara. Under the ordinance, her children are not members of the Santa Clara because she is married to a Navajo from a separate reservation. The testimony was clear that the children could be registered in the Navajo Nation had they so desired. The questions presented for this court, as I see them, are whether or not there's an implied waiver of sovereign immunity in the 1968 Civil Rights Act, and whether, in fact, the Civil Rights Act gives federal courts jurisdiction in anything other than habeas corpus provisions.
That's really the first question, isn't it?
Yes, sir. That is the threshold question. If we get past that question, assuming that the court should find that there
then
is, in fact...
Then you get to sovereign immunity.
Yes, sir. Of course, immunity would go to jurisdiction. If they are immune, there would be no jurisdiction in any court.
Well, but there might be, yes, that's correct, but there might be federal jurisdiction over individuals who are not immune.
Under the habeas corpus, Your Honor, we submit that there would be jurisdiction over the individual that might detain any given
Santa Clara even against the governor, for example.
The Act states that it applies to tribes. Mm-hmm. It does not say anything about the executives. The argument has been made that it would apply to the governor. And based on what I've indicated a while ago, the governor just has the power to run the day-to-day affairs and has no power beyond that into the council area. So I don't know what effect that would have. If, as Your Honor pointed out, there is jurisdiction, then we get to the question of what standard of equal protection should apply under the Indian Civil Rights Act. We have submitted, have argued consistently, that it is something less than the 14th Amendment standard, and that has been admitted by the plaintiffs at the early stages of this proceeding.
Everybody, at least all the parties here, plus the amicus, all seem to agree on that.
I think that is correct.
Isn't that correct? The question is, how much less, sir?
Speaking of the waiver of sovereign immunity, it has been over 145 years that this court held that tribes are sovereign nations, notwithstanding that they're quasi-sovereign at this particular time. They still retain the independent political sovereignty that was found by the court over 100 years ago. 82 years ago, at least, it has been recognized that as sovereigns, they are immune from suit in federal courts unless Congress, and Congress has plenary power to do so, unless Congress enacts legislation saying that they can be sued or that their immunity is waived. Such waiver has never been implied, and we submit that it should not be at this time. It must be an express waiver, and Congress must spell this out. This court, in the recent case of the Puyallup Tribe of Washington, decided just in June, again reaffirmed the common law principle of sovereign immunity. The reasons for this principle have been pointed out are twofold. One is because of the limited resources of the tribes to be constantly in court defending their culture, their way of living, and the other is so that they may continue to perpetuate their culture without interference from an outside alien culture, if you will. The plaintiffs, and I might point out that there has been a $500,000 judgment under the Indian Civil Rights Act in the Tenth Circuit, as pointed out by amicus just recently.
What are the other elements beside preservation of a particular culture that...
The elements are the preservation of the culture, the preservation of the tribal cohesiveness, the unit of the tribe, their religious beliefs, and to some extent their economic holdings, which are, as I've indicated, small. It's the overall keeping of a tribe that's existed for years that is slowly, under this approach, going to be destroyed.
Well, the Anglo-Saxon adversary legal system is quite inconsistent with the tradition of many Indian tribes, isn't it?
It is totally inconsistent, I would say, Your Honor.
But insofar as sovereign immunity goes, that has historic roots as much as anything. In the earlier years, the dealings of our country with the Indian tribes were very similar to the dealings of our country with the government of England or France.
That is correct, Your Honor.
As separate nations and made treaties with them.
And this was done because we were on a more
equal... Sovereign immunity has its historic roots in that concept of what Indian nations were and Indian tribes were.
Based on the more equal footing. At that time, the tribes were stronger compared to what they are today as compared to the United States. And it was beneficial to this country to make such treaties and agreements. And we should continue to honor these.
But that regime was pretty well destroyed, wasn't it, by that 1870 or 71 statute?
It used to be that treaties had to be ratified only by the Senate. And the House complained of that back in the late 60s, wasn't it?
Well, I would not argue that treaties would be entered into at this particular time, Your Honor.
Well, to the extent that bears in sovereignty, there's no longer that. Situation.
Well, it has its roots in the concept reflected in this court's decision in what was a Worcester against Georgia, which within the last two or three terms, in an opinion for the court by Mr. Justice Marshall, was given a good deal of weight, that whole concept.
Going on, Your Honor, if there is a waiver, it must be expressed and should not be implied. We were talking about the reasons for it. Again, the plaintiffs have not told us how they would propose to limit judgments to equitable relief and not have money judgments. The waiver also, I might point out, would have an excessive workload for the courts that the courts may not be geared to, and it would unduly interfere with tribal law and order systems. This was considered.
Part of the argument is that the Civil Rights Act clearly intended to protect individuals from tribal governments in some respects.
Your Honor, my argument on that is that the intention primarily was to avoid criminal-type lack of due process in the courts, in the tribal courts. That was the bulk of the legislative history. There are other mentions of other things.
Could you tell me, would a tribal court have any authority to invalidate a tribal ordinance on the grounds that it was inconsistent with the Civil Rights Act?
If they did not, the Secretary of Interior would definitely have it.
Yeah, I know, but I didn't ask you whether they would or not. Do they have the authority of invalidating an ordinance, or are they just supposed to enforce an ordinance the way it's written?
I missed the initial thrust.
Well, do they have the authority to say, well, we know what the ordinance says, but we refuse to enforce it because it's invalid? Do they have the power of judicial review? And do they have the power to say this ordinance is inconsistent with the Civil Rights Act and therefore it's invalid?
Do the courts have that power?
The tribal courts.
The tribal courts do not. Well, the tribal courts could certainly change this ordinance because they have that authority under the Constitution.
They do?
And they could.
Under the tribal Constitution?
They have the authority to make the ordinance, so I assume that they have the authority to unmake it. They can pass such ordinances.
Can they invalidate it? Not repeal it.
Can they invalidate?
I think that they can.
Well, they're governed by the Civil Rights Act. Only governed by the Civil Rights Act. They not only have the right, but the duty, I would think, to follow the Civil Rights Act, don't they?
Within their tribe, I think that is true.
Is another way of phrasing the question, which is supreme in an Indian tribal court, federal statutory law or Indian tribal law?
Where we would like to think that Indian tribal law
is supreme, and what is the conflict between that and the federal statute?
Subject to the Indian Civil Rights Act now as applied in the context of the Indian tribal courts.
But if an Indian tribal court concluded that the federal Indian Civil Rights Act were violated, would not the federal tribal court have a duty to obey the federal statute?
I think you're correct on that, Your Honor.
Your point was that providing Congress had moved.
Providing Congress is so indicated, and we take the position that Congress has not so indicated. Congress has only indicated that there should be a specific remedy, which is habeas corpus.
It may be that my question is wholly inappropriate because I gather from what you said and what now is in, I think is in the briefs, that legislative and judicial authority are vested in the same body.
In the tribe?
In the tribe.
That is correct.
Pueblo Council.
But they do have and are getting more codes and setting up separate judges under model codes that the Interior Department has promulgated.
And I presume the matter varies from tribe to tribe, does it?
Your Honor, in all of these areas, it varies from tribe to tribe.
Would you just give me an answer to a rather practical problem? Assuming that there is sovereign immunity or no jurisdiction or no implied cause of action, whatever the theory might be, and looking at the portions of the statute other than the criminal procedure portions, provisions such as you can't take property without just compensation and equal protection, does the statute have any practical significance if there is no federal remedy?
It does, because it would be applied within the tribal courts, and it would have the secretary looking over it as far as approving ordinances and reviewing anything that the tribe does that is subject to the secretary's approval. So it would have.
Could the Secretary of the Interior invalidate this particular ordinance?
I think that's probable.
if he felt it violated the statute.
That's correct. Yeah. He would have had to approve it initially.
This ordinance has been approved by the Secretary.
This ordinance was approved, I believe, and I don't want to be held to that, Your Honor. I think it was approved when it was passed.
But that meant that it was approved. That means it was approved, if you're correct, before the enactment of the Indian Civil Rights Act.
That is correct. The jurisdictional issue, reliance has been placed on 28 U.S.C. 1343-4, and I submit that this reliance is misplaced. That requires that the district court shall have jurisdiction of any civil action authorized by laws to be commenced. And we submit that nothing has been authorized in the Civil Rights Act except habeas corpus. And as a result, reliance on this is improper. And this court has ruled in similar cases under the Tucker Act and the Administrative Procedure Act in Califano v. Sanders and in Teston recently.
Well, the governor is a party defendant here, isn't he?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, so even assuming that that you're right on the jurisdictional question as to the tribe, does it make any difference as long as the relief that sought can be obtained against the governor, couldn't it?
Your Honor, it makes a difference because I think that the act specifically applies to tribes, number one, and secondly, because the governor himself would not have the authority, the council would have the authority to promulgate ordinances concerning membership.
No, but in a dispute over whether the ordinance is consistent with the Indian, with the Rights Act, couldn't that be determined and if found inconsistent and invalid because inconsistent with the Civil Rights Act, couldn't there be an appropriate remedy just against the governor without reference to the tribe?
It is my position that it would not be proper.
I see. Why?
Because I think the act speaks to the tribe itself and not to an individual, and that the governor does not have the requisite authority in any event to tell the council. I would assume then the council would have to become also involved because the governor does not have the authority to tell the council.
Mr. Bell, without regard to the Civil Rights Act, what authority does the governor have? Is he the chief executive officer?
He is the chief executive, and he's entitled.
Well, I thought you said he didn't enforce the ordinance.
He enforces the law and order portions of it, but he doesn't have the authority to pass an ordinance or to knock out an ordinance. That would be within the council.
But he has authority to enforce it.
He has the authority to enforce it.
Well, then why isn't he subject to suit?
If he enforces it wrongfully, he perhaps could be subject to suit.
For short order, I think this court said that a governor of a certain state of Ohio was subject to suit.
Therefore, in the Indian context, it would not necessarily follow because of the different
power. Well, I want to understand what you say. The governor is nothing. He just sits there. And that cannot be true.
He does not just sit there. He runs the day-to-day affairs.
Well, why isn't he subject to suit if he runs the day-to-day affairs?
Because the act addresses tribes.
He does what?
Addresses tribes. It says no tribe shall. Well, it does not say no
well,
person.
Well, who is the tribe?
I submit that the council, and I don't know, the religious leaders, these are things we don't know, the people behind the secular people.
Well, what did Congress mean when they said tribe?
I think they meant the political body
you
through
think
the council.
You help me a little better than thinking?
They must have meant the political body, which would be the council.
You mean there's nothing there one way or the other?
No, it's not clear what they meant. As to the standard of equal protection, it is clear that this court has consistently taken the approach that Indians are sui generis and different from any other body in the country. They've been treated with deference. Things have been considered by this court that had it been any other group, a different ruling would have been arrived at. For example, Morton v. Mancari, Fisher case. We think that Congress intended that the remedy of habeas corpus be applied, and that they would later look at the entire case, and if that was not sufficient, they can enact new legislation and mandate to the courts what they want. Congress did not intend to prohibit Indian tribes from maintaining their traditional criteria for establishing their membership. I might point out that not only Santa Clara is affected by the Court of Appeals decision, but every tribe in the nation, 13 tribes, as noticed in amicus briefs, 13 other tribes in the nation have either female or male descendancy rules. So it is not just a question of Santa Clara. It's a question of all Indian nations throughout the country. All tribes are struggling to remain culturally and politically viable right now, and they're finding it difficult because a tremendous amount of lawsuits are being filed against them. And Congress and this court have continually stressed that they're in favor of tribal self-determination and tribal self-autonomy. If we read the ICRA in the context of all of these laws, it appears fairly obvious to me that the full impact of the 14th Amendment was not intended.
How big is this tribe? Of course, 12, the answer to that question may depend on the outcome of this lawsuit, but approximately how big is it?
It's 48.
How many?
48,000 acres and 1,200.
1,200.
Members.
Men, women, and children.
That is correct, Your Honor. And I might point out that approximately 10% of those that live on the Pueblo now are in the class of plaintiff Audrey Martinez is in. And
so
they've never been asked to leave the Pueblo.
Might be, whatever it is, 1,020 instead of 1,200. Huh?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Or 1,080, I guess.
The cases below have held basically that equal, even-handed application of the law is what should be applied. If it is in the Indian context, if it is in the Anglo-American context, then they have, in fact, applied the 14th Amendment standards. And nothing could be more Indian context than membership. The 10th Circuit recognized this, but proceeded to apply the compelling test. They didn't talk about rational or substantially further important governmental objective. They said they have shown no compelling interest. I submit that this court, not even in Frontier or in Richardson or any other case, has agreed totally that the compelling interest should be shown in a gender-type case. Further submit that the court has retreated to some extent from that holding and now hold that they must show a substantially further important governmental objective, that the ordinance would do so. And I submit that nothing could be more important than the culture and the actual existence of a tribe, and that it clearly comes within the standard in Craig v. Borden. However, the 10th Circuit did apply the improper rule. We have also asked the court to consider treating this case similar to immigration laws in the United States. The tribes and the countries are quite similar in that membership in a tribe is similar to citizenship in a country. This court in Fialo has taken the position that they will not interfere in that, that Congress should make those decisions, and that the court will not second-guess Congress. I submit that that is certainly a proper test to apply in this particular case. When we look at the background concerning whether or not the ordinance is proper, we need to see that the rule has been uniformly applied since it was enacted. The undisputed testimony was that from a Dr. Ellis, who was hired by the government, not by the tribe initially, that the culture would eventually break down and be lost if this ordinance were not allowed. This type of testimony was elicited also from the governor and other members of the tribe. And I submit that they feel very strongly that this is true, because the father is a party that passes down the custom and culture, and it is through him that all of these things are taught to the children. Without this ordinance, it's just a question of time before this tribe would cease to exist, notwithstanding the fact that it's existed for 700 plus years. The court below found that the tribe was patrilocal, patricultural, indicating that everything descended through the father, and that the ordinance itself was rooted in deep tradition. To say that the ordinance cannot stand would be to terminate the very tribe that these plaintiffs would be members of. And that clearly they do not want. The record is clear that the cultural impact of a non-Santa Clara mother is very minimal as compared to that of a Santa Clara father. My time is running out.
Mr. Collins.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. One of the basic disagreements between the parties in this case has been the defendant's characterization of what tribal interest is represented by this ordinance that's at issue here. They have said, as counsel just said at the close of his argument, that without this ordinance, the culture and religion of Santa Clara would be lost and destroyed. We submit that this cannot possibly be the case. The court below and the district court, in their opinions, each stated that the Martinez children are culturally Santa Clara Indians. They found that to be a fact. That finding is undisputed so far before this court. Furthermore, that finding is based on a number of significant subsidiary facts that are also undisputed, that the Martinez children are full-blood American Indians, that their mother is a full-blood Santa Clara Indian, that they speak and understand the Tewa language, which is the official and legal language of the Santa Clara Pueblo. In fact, the expert witness for defendants, to which counsel just referred, defined a Santa Clara Indian as a Tewa Indian as one who speaks the Tewa language. She defined the Indians in question according to the language.
Mr. Collins, is your point addressed to the factual question of whether or not these children will kind of fit in the Santa Clara Pueblo, or whether the federal district court, as opposed to the Indian tribe, should determine what the traditions of the tribe are?
Mr. Justice, my point is addressed to the tribal interest asserted as a justification for this ordinance. They have constantly said that without the ordinance, their culture would be lost, and we submit that can't be the case because the persons who are so closely identified with the culture as these persons are excluded by the ordinance, and conversely, the ordinance mandates the admission of male line children, even if they grow up in Chicago or Los Angeles or what have you, even if they're half or a quarter or less Indian ancestry, even if they've never seen Santa Clara Pueblo, even if they know nothing of its language.
But this is like a Baptist telling the Pope that he's wrong about the Immaculate Conception, in a sense, isn't it? I mean, presumably the best authority is to Indian tribal standards or culture is the word of the tribe itself, if we're simply talking about that.
Well, Your Honor, the issue of culture was raised by the defendants, not by the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs suggest that the record is clear that this ordinance was not based on any cultural interest of the Pueblo, but based on a desire to limit membership to hold down to keep up the amount of the per capita payments that the government was making to the tribe. We think the record's clear on that. Culture was raised by them as a defense. Now, we're forced to meet that, but we didn't raise the issue. We don't think that we don't. And furthermore, Your Honor, in any Indian Civil Rights Act case, a tribe that has any differing traditions from a state or local government under the United States is going to have some cultural involvement in that decision. And therefore, the Indian Civil Rights, if tradition or culture were an automatic and absolute defense to an Indian Civil Rights Act action, then the act is meaningless.
That I can understand, that Congress has said tradition and culture will have to be overridden in some situations. But I thought your point was that here, even though the tribe says its culture and tradition aren't being overridden, the tribe is really mistaken because Judge Meacham and Judge Doyle decided that it wouldn't be.
No, Your Honor, not that at all. We're only saying that the record, we think, is overwhelmingly clear that the cultural defense is mistakenly raised by the defendants because it cannot possibly maintain culture to enforce a rule like this. That's what Judge Doyle
isn't
so
the,
clearly said in
isn't
the...
Isn't the point as to who is to be a member of the tribe involved in the cultural survival of that tribe?
Well, it is, Your Honor. That goes to a different
point.
Well,
isn't that basic?
Yes, it is basic, Mr.
Is
Justice.
Is it as important as citizenship is to the citizen of the United States?
It's as basic to
is
the
it?
Plaintiffs.
Is it as important?
I can't answer that, Your Honor. I think they're rather different. I don't think that they're
different to
they're
what
necessarily
extent?
Equivalent.
Different to what extent? As to the culture of the two.
Well, United States citizenship issues usually arise in the case of an alien, someone who's not brought up in the culture of the United States. If these plaintiffs are denied membership in the tribe that they were brought up in, they've lived all their lives on the reservation, the loss to them would be much greater than the effect on a true alien
talking about the loss to the individual. I'm talking about the culture.
Yes, sir.
I'm saying that who is eligible to be a member of a tribe is as important as anything I know of to a culture.
But I'm saying, Your Honor, that there's a...
C-U-L-T-U-R-E is what I'm talking about.
Yes, Your Honor, but I'm talking about the fact that there's a crucial difference in the cultural impact between outsiders, persons who have not grown up in the society, and persons, insiders, those who have.
Couldn't they have set up a culture and said, you can't be a member of the tribe? Get out. Unless you're a full-blooded tribal Indian of this tribe, get out. Is there anything wrong with that?
Well, Your Honor,
if the council adopts that, that presents
very different questions. I don't know, Your Honor. What they've done here is to pass a rule that discriminates between members of the tribe. It says to women, your children may not become members.
Well, you assume that they're members of the tribe, and I thought that's what we were here to decide.
Oh, Your Honor, there's no doubt that Plaintiff Julia Martinez is a member. It's her
for certain purposes.
For all purposes.
No, sir.
Your Honor, that's a mistake that counsel made. There is nothing in the record to indicate that there's an inheritance rule through the man only in this tribe. Nothing in the record. That's a mischaracterization of the record, because it's clear enough that if Mrs. Martinez had married a member of the tribe, her children could inherit from her. There's no prohibition against inheritance through the female line. The only thing is there's a prohibition against passing membership to your children, but not a prohibition against inheritance as a general matter.
Mr. Collins, it's far be it from me to direct the order of your argument, but I hope before you sit down you will address what I consider to be very important preliminary questions, i.e. whether or not there was federal court jurisdiction of this case, and if so, whether or not the tribe could be sued, because only if the answer to both of those questions is yes, do we get into any of these issues that you and some of the members of the bench have been discussing?
Mr. Justice, I'll be happy to address those.
You do it in your own time and in your own order, of course.
The two jurisdictional issues that have been raised are whether there's federal court subject matter jurisdiction and whether the sovereign immunity of the tribe precludes such jurisdiction. The inquiry into those is fairly detailed, and I must refer in part to our briefs, but I'll outline our answers to the contentions. The main answer is we contend that Congress contemplated that these kinds of reviews would be heard by the federal courts. And in fact, this is the 10th year of this statute, the lower federal courts, all four court of appeals that have looked at this statute have said we have the power to review and that sovereign immunity doesn't bar that review.
In 25-1303 of the Act, Congress expressly conferred habeas jurisdiction on the federal courts. It did not expressly confer any other kind of jurisdiction. Don't you have to meet the argument that expressio unius exclusio, whatever the Latin word is, alterius?
Yes, Your Honor. There are several responses to that. In the first place, there's no legislative history to suggest that Congress thought that was an exclusive remedy. In the second place, habeas corpus in the federal code is always a statutory remedy at the present time. It has been for some years. And equitable remedies, especially exercised against government officers, have usually not been a statutory remedy. That's the normal assumption. Furthermore, The legislative history is a confusing point here, because we're relying on different parts of the legislative history, and I think it's really essential to answer this question and some others to make clear where the legislative history lies. Counsel for defendants has principally relied upon hearings, upon testimony before hearings, including testimony of persons who opposed passage of the Act. We submit that that doesn't accurately reflect what Congress intended to do. There is one and only one committee report on this bill, on the bill that became this act, or any of the bills leading up to it, a report of the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1967. In that report, the senators state, they have a section on unconstitutional actions of tribal governments, discussing the subject. In that section, they refer to five decisions of the lower federal courts denying a civil remedy in a civil non-custody context to Indians in disputes with their tribes, and they're obviously expressing disapproval of those decisions. One of those five arose in the context of tribal membership. We submit that the report of the senators themselves indicates that they contemplated that the federal courts would review membership cases, and the other cases in that report are, there are two cases on freedom, free exercise of religion, and there's a case on tribal taxation of members, and there's a case on tribal taxation of non-Indians on the reservation. In all of those, the senators were expressing disapproval of the lack of a remedy for those plaintiffs. And they were saying that this is why this act was passed.
Is the free exercise of religion clause incorporated in the Indian Bill of Rights?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. But there's no anti-establishment clause. How one differentiates between those is yet to come. Now, returning to the sovereign immunity question, the terms of the act are mandatory on their face. The act is a limitation on the tribes themselves. Congress, it's conceded, has plenary power to limit the tribes in this way. Defendants have conceded that. That's not the power of Congress to do this isn't at issue. It's only a question of what Congress did do.
Well, then, if, as you say, it's a limitation on the tribes, it's a limitation on the tribal courts, isn't it?
Yes, in fact, Your Honor.
And it sets out substantive law, paramount substantive law, that the tribal courts must follow.
Well, in this case, the tribal court and the tribal legislature are one and the same. The lower courts have developed a rule with which we have no quarrel, a salutary rule saying that a plaintiff to bring a case to the federal courts must first exhaust all his internal remedies within the tribes. We have no quarrel with that rule. The district court found without contradiction that we had done that in this case. And, of course, that, I'm sure, has resolved in the context of some other tribes a number of disputes, the existence of that rule. But this tribe has no separate court. There's no separate review. All you can do is go back to the same officers with whom you have a quarrel. And in addition,
And point out the provision of the Indian Civil Rights Act upon which you rely.
Well, that was attempted for 2 years before this case was filed.
In any court system, you reach the end of the line somewhere.
Well,
even though you think you've been wronged. You come to this court, it's the end of the line. If there were a reviewing court for this court, it wouldn't be.
But you do agree that it's not like a court because all they can do is change the rule.
Yes, Your
Honor.
They
can't say that the rule violates the Civil
Rights
Act. Yes.
I was just answering the inquiry, really, that was made during my brother's argument.
Right. But you agree, basically, on the structure, the council, the governor, et cetera, that he has, that the governor has no more power than he just is there?
Well, the written constitution of the Pueblo says that he has all the executive authority of the Pueblo, the authority to enforce all the laws, and we assumed that included membership laws. We still assume that. We take the written laws at their word. It's in the appendix. We would point out in connection with this scope of the act again that the act on its face limits, and these are the words of the statute, all governmental powers possessed by an Indian tribe, executive, legislative, and judicial, and all offices, bodies, and tribunals by and through which they are executed, including courts. So it's comprehensive. The act on its face, in its terms, is comprehensive in defining what it limits. That relates to one of the arguments that's been made by my brother, which is that the Equal Protection Clause of this act should be interpreted only to enforce existing tribal rules even-handedly, I believe they call it. In the first place, of course, the act says that the legislative councils of the tribe are limited as well as the administrative. And this even-handed rule, of course, would only go to the administration of the law. And in the second place, such a rule would make a mockery of the Equal Protection Clause because as soon as an uneven application arose, all that would be necessary to make it immune from any review would be for the legislature to codify that rule. So that rule makes no sense to us. And we submit that Congress could not possibly have intended such an undertaking, particularly since Congress paid special attention, the senators paid special attention to the Equal Protection Clause in this law. When the law was drafted by the Interior Department, there was an Equal Protection Clause in it that guaranteed equal protection only to members of the tribe. And the senators didn't like that, and they changed it and guaranteed equal protection to all persons under tribal jurisdiction, a point which has been noted by lower courts in some other cases. So the senators took a particular look at the question of equal protection, and they rejected a narrower clause. In which regard, I might add, a reply brief was just filed by petitioners in which they quote some legislative history about equal protection, and they quote legislative history about that rejected clause applying only to members of the tribe, and they don't disclose that. And so I think the court should note that that legislative history does not apply to the clause that was actually enacted by the Congress.
Well, what standard do you think applies here if there is jurisdiction and you reach the merits? Do you defend the opinion of the Court of Appeals?
I suppose not in every last particular, Your Honor.
Well, what standard do you suggest?
We have, again, I must refer to our briefs because it's a detailed discussion of the subject, but what we say there is that a lot of the faulty analysis, I think, a lot of the fears that have been raised under equal protection analysis with regard to Indian tribes derive from a totally faulty source. They've taken the result in state cases and transferred it laterally to Indian tribes, and we clearly say that that's not correct. The Equal Protection Clause must be applied in the context of whatever government or society it's being applied to. And for that reason, we concede that the sensitive issue of membership is entitled to wait in an analyzing an equal protection situation.
You mean the tribe's judgment?
The tribe's judgment and the tribe's standards and the tribe's traditions are entitled to wait. But the problem with this particular rule is that they claim it's a rule based in culture, and it actually has a counterproductive effect on culture. I'm not trying to say that it's the function of the courts to determine every last cultural nuance of the tribe, but I'm saying...
So you think, Judge, the Tenth Circuit's approach is generally acceptable, a balancing...
Yes, Your Honor, a balancing approach of that kind... Well, I don't know if balancing is the correct word.
Well, whatever it was...
Governmental justifications in all the different formulas that are used with regard to the Equal Protection Clause, the different verbal formulas, governmental interests are always accorded weight according to the circumstances.
And you can't get it up any more balled up than we have. So.
Yeah, speak freely.
I was trying to address different points of view. Whatever verbal formula is used, the governmental interests are accorded weight. And since the Indian governmental interests in many contexts will be different, we think that that raises different analyses for application of the clause.
Membership is rather a fundamental question, isn't it?
Membership is a fundamental... In fact, Your Honor, you have to consider also the importance to the plaintiffs. The Interior Department issued a decision in 1969, a year after this act was enacted, in which they termed tribal membership for a person raised in the Pueblo, a child, like this was a different tribe, not a Pueblo tribe, to be a fundamental interest. The Interior Department decision called it that. And they ruled that a tribal rule was invalid on that ground. That raises a point that was made earlier about Secretary of Interior review. The problem with the suggestion that that's a sufficient remedy is, in the first place, by the way, I must correct the record. There's nothing on the record to indicate that the Secretary of the Interior ever approved this rule. We tried mightily to find out at the time of trial if he had. There's no evidence either way whether it was ever approved or disapproved.
For the purpose of applying the Indian Civil Rights Act, what is a tribe? It says no Indian tribe will...
There's a statutory definition, Your Honor. It says, Indian tribe means any tribe, band, or other group of Indians subject to the jurisdiction of the United States and recognized as possessing powers of self-government. That's the statutory definition.
And so if a group of Indians, wants to be recognized as a tribe, you have to decide what the tribe is in the first place. You have to, and they just say, here is our tribe, here are our members.
Well,
They list various members.
In 19th century case law, Your Honor, there were a fair number of decisions in this court that adjudicated that kind of a question. And what the court basically said is that's a political question for the Congress and the executive branch. But
for the Indian tribe. Yeah.
Do you mean to
define itself?
I thought you were referring to tribal recognition by the United States.
I'm just wondering if. It seems to me that an Indian tribe, if it wants to be recognized, it says, we want to be a tribe and here are our members. Now, if the secretary accepts that and people who are excluded from the list complain, can the courts adjudicate that?
I think they could adjudicate it. I think it presents very different substantive questions and very different substantive questions from this case. The thing about membership is a sensitive issue, and we concede that, but it's extremely important issue for the plaintiffs in this case, having been raised in the culture. And for that very reason, it's of less importance to the tribe in this case than would be the question of an outsider. It's like the difference between a person born and raised in the United States applying for citizenship versus a person born and raised in France. That difference, we think, goes to the fundamental irrationality of this statute.
So you're saying, as applied to this particular plaintiff, the ordinance is invalid?
That's right, Your Honor.
Of course, we have 10, 12 odd amicus briefs from other tribes here saying that it is of tremendous importance to the tribe, the particular question here.
Well, I realize that, Your Honor, but I think what they're saying is they don't want any of their membership rules examined ever, which I can understand their position, but I don't think they're examining the particular facts of this case very exactly when they say that. To expel someone as culturally identified with the tribe as the Martinez children are cannot possibly have the importance to the culture of the tribe as they ascribe it. It just can't.
Well, but how can either you or I know that with confidence?
Your Honor, again, that leads down the slope to the notion that nothing is reviewable so long as there's some cultural input into it. Unfortunately, Congress in passing the act has said, Congress in passing the act has said that tribal laws are subject to review. All of those tribal laws are passed in a social and cultural milieu that's somewhat different from a state. And occasionally, issues are bound to arise where, as a defense to some act, a tribe says, well, we are allowed to do that for cultural reasons. We, again, are only trying to meet that defense. We're not suggesting that this court or any court should determine tribal tradition or culture.
But I thought you were saying their cultural reasons are really not very good ones, even if cultural reasons were relevant.
Well, I am saying that, though, with regard only to a rather clear and dramatic and undisputed fact in this case, which is the notion of insiders versus outsiders, the notion that these people are raised in the society, admitted to the religion. In the literature, if you were admitted to the religion of this Pueblo 100 years ago, that was tantamount to membership. Things have changed. The Bureau of Indian Affairs came along and said to this tribe, you've got to have a written tribal role. That's something new. That came along in the 30s. And then they came along and they said, we've taken some land away from you and we're going to pay you some money. And that gave rise to per capita payments. And if you look at the legislative history in the Pueblo's own records and the testimony in the record in this case, it's clear that what the council had in mind when they passed this rule was keeping those per capita payments up. Nothing more, nothing less.
Mr. Collins, have you answered Mr. Justice Stewart?
I doubt entirely, Your Honor. To continue on that point, Mr. Justice, on the point of jurisdiction, rather, there is a long tradition in the federal courts of enforcing the Constitution against future violations by equitable relief against governments deriving from the principle of ex parte Young. And we suggest that...
Well, that doesn't go to federal jurisdiction. That goes to immunity.
Yes, sir.
The very first question is whether or not the federal courts have jurisdiction. Now, federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. Generally, jurisdiction is expressly and explicitly conferred by Congress within the meets and bounds of the Constitution. There certainly was no explicit conferral of jurisdiction in this case. You would agree with that. The only explicit conferral of jurisdiction upon the federal courts was with respect to habeas corpus proceedings. So the question is there jurisdiction implicitly conferred? Isn't that it?
Yes, Your Honor, and we think the answer...
I know that most every federal court that has passed on it to date has held yes, there is.
Well, we think the reasoning of those courts is correct, and the two statutes that have been relied upon are 1331, on the ground that these actions arise under the laws of the United States, and 1343, the civil rights jurisdiction, by analogy to the decisions of this court in such cases as Allen against Board of Elections, that's a particularly relevant case, the Allen against Board of Elections case, because the court implied a private civil remedy in that case in spite of the fact that the statute involved in that case, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, contained a narrower civil remedy, not criminal, not habeas corpus or something else, within the statute. And in other actions under 42 U.S.C. 1981, 42 U.S.C. 1982, and other circumstances, the court has implied a private civil remedy to enforce the Constitution or enforce civil rights-type laws. And
is that a private civil remedy, but then you look somewhere for jurisdiction?
No, well, if the remedy is in the intent of the statute, Mr. Justice,
yes,
then 1343 does give you a remedy. That seems to me undisputed. The only question is where the remedy comes from. If there is a remedy, and we say there is, then 1343 gives the court subject matter jurisdiction. Now, again, I would refer to Mr. Justice Stewart. I would refer to the legislative history of the statute, with the senators saying, "We disapprove of these cases where the federal courts have dismissed actions by individual Indians trying to rectify a membership case, tax case, free exercise case." The senators in the written word have indicated their intent that there be a remedy. They're disapproving expressly of cases where a remedy was denied.
Well, presumably, if, as you say, the tribal governments in all their branches, including their judicial branch, and I realize that sometimes in some tribes the judicial and the executive are one, but if they're all governed by this substantive federal law, then that's where the remedy arguably could be, there and only there.
Well, Your Honor, it's like any other civil rights statute.
It doesn't necessarily follow that just because Congress thought that these substantive rights should be accorded,
yes,
individual Indians, that necessarily that they be invoked in federal district courts. Why couldn't they be invoked in the courts of the Indian tribes?
Well, the federal courts have said that they must be first invoked in the courts of the tribes. But
exclusively. Why is it an ineluctable inference that federal courts have jurisdiction?
Because it's fundamental civil rights that are at issue, Your Honor, and the court has a consistent. In the Bivens case, the court found a remedy under the Constitution itself, and it's clear from the legislative
under
history.
1331,
the senators
jurisdiction
said,
of the federal courts.
Well, we've relied on 1331, Your Honor, and the senators over and over said we are applying certain constitutional provisions to these Indian tribes. That's what we're doing, is applying the Constitution in the context of disputes by any person against an Indian tribe. And it seems to me the analogy is quite precise, that if the action arises under the Constitution, it's the same kind of reasoning as in Bivens and Bell against Hood.
Well, are you saying that the Indian Civil Rights Act is equivalent to the Constitution?
No, Your Honor, because Congress only applied certain portions of the Constitution to the Indian tribes, and they altered other portions. But we do say that those portions they applied are equivalent. Yes, I think the legislative record is rather clear on that.
So that you don't have to decide whether you're bringing an action under whether this is a statutory action or a constitutional action?
I think, well, it's a statutory action, Your Honor, because it's contained in a statute, but it seems to us that the reasoning by analogy to cases like Bivens is apt because Congress intended by the statute to apply the Constitution itself in the respects in which it did so. It omitted Republican form of government. It omitted all kinds of parts of the Constitution quite intentionally and for good reason. But where it did apply the Constitution, we suggest that the analogy to other civil rights cases is apt in this regard. And we would also cite to the court the court's own reasoning in the court against Ash. I don't have time to go down the four steps in that reasoning, but
the fourth step of court against Ash, frankly,
yes,
is the one that seems to me raises the most difficult problem of whether the cause of action is one traditionally relegated to state law. Now, here, of course, it would be traditionally relegated to Indian law. Why doesn't that defeat you?
Well, Your Honor, because, again, we're talking about equal protection of the law, which is certainly a provision of the Constitution that's generally been enforced in the federal courts and not elsewhere, not in the state courts in the analogous situation. And secondly, because the whole history of this act is replete with the notion that Congress was dissatisfied in certain respects with the treatment of tribal members by the Indian tribes. And what they're saying...
But surely it is correct, is it not, that the tribal membership matters are probably the classic example of the kind of thing that's traditionally relegated to the Indians to decide for themselves.
Well, Your Honor, so has every other constitutional question, because the Constitution has never been applied to the tribes before at all. We acknowledge the sensitivity of membership, and we think that's entitled to some weight, but that doesn't... They're trying to say that any membership rule, no matter how arbitrary, no matter how trivial, no matter how ill-conceived, is entitled to any review under this statute. Under the First Amendment is applied, under the Equal Protection Clause is applied, under due process is applied, and Congress in the legislative history indicated express disapproval of a Tenth Circuit decision denying a remedy to an Indian in just such a dispute.
They did not include in the statute itself a counterpart to Section 1983. That's the problem.
What would happen if a male member of a tribe, one of these matriarchal tribes, brings action?
Well, Your Honor, we would, if you're talking about some other tribe, I think there are other traditions, and I think that each membership rule arises in the context of that tribe, and each membership rule arises in the context of its own history. We say it's clear on this record that the sole purpose of this rule was to keep up those per capita payments. It had no purpose to retain any, the rule before 1939.
And the answer to my question is?
That it would be a different case.
Thank you. That's the best you can do.
Mr. Collins, may I ask one other very brief question? You referred to the exhaustion of tribal remedies. There's no question about that here. Does the record tell us just what efforts your client did make to receive some kind of remedy from the tribe or from the Secretary of Interior or something like that?
The transcript was, Your Honor, the matter, by the time it got to submission to the district court, the matter was essentially not very much contested, and so the district court didn't write very much about it. Essentially, there was a long history spanning some 18 years of attempts by Mrs. Martinez to get her children enrolled.
Thank you.
Mr. Pelo, you have time left. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.